Before going on, let's take a few moments to hear again what Vic and Sade was really like. Let's go back to March 12, 1942.
Get ready to smile again with radio's home folks, Vic and Sade, written by Paul Reiner.
Well, sir, it's a minute or two past 12 o'clock as we enter the small house halfway up in the next block now. And here in the kitchen, we find Mrs. Victor Gook and her son, Mr. Rush Gook. The table is set for the noonday meal, and our friends are hovering beside the gas stove, chatting idly.
Plain Brain Whooper up at school claims he's related to your friends Edith and Raleigh, Ma.
Oh?
His locker's right next to mine in the gymnasium, and we were sitting on the bench this morning, lacing up our shoes, and just to make talk, I mentioned my mother had very dear friends in Kentucky with the same name as his.
And he said he was related?
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure it was just axle grease and peach butter. He talked too glib, see?
He
isn't Raleigh Whooper, he says. Why, bless your heart, chum, the family connection is terrible close. My Aunt Eleanor married a man named Borchardt, and they had two children, Roy and Tetsy. I've all...
Listen.
Them.
Huh? Yes?
That's the high horse to hold.
Well, coming in the front door these days, aren't we?
Probably walked up Virginia Avenue with Steve Chestbutter and absentmindedly walked up on the porch.
I bet my wife's furious because I used the front door. Is my wife furious because I used the front door?
We do have some rules and regulations.
I can explain. Well, Rush, I find you home.
Greetings, yeah.
No, but about using the front door, it seems to me, as long as we agree we ought to come in the back, it isn't fair for one party to do the one thing and the other...
That's pity. Not another word, pity. You're very angry now, I know, but in just a second you're going to be angry as still.
Why?
Because I'm not eating dinner here this noon.
Oh?
I'm sorry and sick with regret and offer 1,000 apologies, but it's just one of those things. The only reason I come home was to get a clean shirt. Rush, trot up and get Papa a clean shirt. A white one.
Okay.
Scoot, my dear.
I want to hear why you're not eating with us.
Because I'm dining with business associates at the little tiny petite pheasant feather tea shoppy.
Oh.
Now, Scoot.
Okay.
You might also bring down with you my blue necktie with the white dot.
All right.
I got lovely stuff fixed for you.
Yes, and it smells mighty, mighty good.
You might at least have telephoned or something.
I couldn't. I didn't know. This all come up on the spur of the moment. Oh, well, that's the penalty of being a cog in the wheel of big business. A man must adjust himself to circumstances. A man must be prepared to alter the pattern of his regimen at any second.
Gonna eat at the little tiny feathered weather, huh?
The little tiny petite pheasant feather tea shoppy.
Who else? Go on.
An extremely illustrious group. Your poor husband, I fear, will be badly overshadowed.
Mr. Buller in town?
Mr. Buller's in town, and guess who else is in town?
Who?
Mr. Gus Fuss. The brilliant kitchenware executive from Dubuque, Iowa.
Oh?
Those two luminaries are going to dinner. The chief himself, Mr. Rubish, is going to dinner. And your wretched husband makes a fortune.
Say, you are eating with the hotshot blue blood.
Of course, I'm awful darn sorry to throw a wrench in your household machinery.
Oh, well. Well, how'd they happen to pick out the little shoppy-de-woppy?
Buller's idea.
Big, enormous dignitaries like Mr. Rubush generally eat at the Butler House Hotel, don't they?
Yeah, the little tiny petite pheasant feather tea shoppy was Buller's notion. He's been there before, you know. He likes it.
You got two blue neckties with white spots, Doc. I brought down the one that looked the newest.
Yes, and you used your head. You are a good boy. One of these days, it is extremely unlikely that I give you $0.50.
Okay.
I will now change my shirt.
Fine.
You people needn't mind me. Sit down and eat your dinner.
Won't be ready for a few minutes yet.
Uh-huh.
Your father's dining with big, important muckety-mucks this noon.
Oh?
Mr. Rubish, Mr. Buller, and Mr. Gus Fuss of Dubuque, Iowa.
Well,
I trust you're proud of your father?
Sure.
It astonishes me why they should pick out that little tiny tea shoppy-de-floppy.
Mr. Buller admires their home cooking and the generous serving. He was greatly pleased with both the service and the cuisine when he was there before.
Oh, it's such a dinky establishment.
It's modest, yes.
What's the matter?
Ready?
You suddenly stopped, unbuttoning your shirt, and stared off into space.
Oh, did I?
I was just telling Mommy about Rain Brain Vooper up at school. Yes, it seems Rain Brain Vooper says...
Yeah?
You want to hear something funny?
Sure.
You were mentioning the little tiny petite pheasant bed at tea shop. He reminded me.
Oh?
Kind of a ridiculous situation.
Huh?
It might amuse you and it might not. It amuses me.
Oh, what is it?
Mr. Buller was determined to take us three guys to the little tiny petite pheasant feather tea shop.
Uh-huh.
So he made arrangements with Mrs. Grice, the proprietor.
Hmm.
And now comes the funny part.
Yes? Well, what's the funny part?
Mrs. Grice is only three tables in her restaurant.
Yes, I know.
Well, as luck would have it, two of these tables had already been reserved before Mr. Buller showed up.
Well?
Some family party or other reserved these two tables and made arrangements with Mrs. Grice to seat 11 persons.
11 persons at two tables?
Exactly. Necessitates some crowding.
Yes, I'd imagine.
Necessitates some crowding.
How does this affect you and Mr. Ubrich and Mr. Buller and Mr. Fuss?
Yeah, how does it?
Well, as a matter of fact, I personally am the one affected.
Oh.
Here comes the funny part.
Oh.
Sit down and enjoy your dinner, you people.
It's not ready.
Oh. How's the shirt look?
All right.
Uh-huh.
What's the funny part?
Funny part. Oh, sure, the funny part.
Oh.
Well, on account of this half-wit family party cluttering up the tea shoppy, our table has to be shoved against the wall. And no matter how the three tables are placed, our table will only seat three persons.
Somebody has to stand up and eat?
No.
You have to stand up and eat?
Nobody has to stand up and eat. Everybody gets to sit down.
Uh-huh.
However, a makeshift arrangement did have to be devised.
And you're the goat.
What?
I can tell by your actions and the expression on your face you've been rung in on something and feel foolish about it.
Oh, now, hey.
What makeshift arrangement was devised?
Well, it worked out very simply. Our table is to be shoved up against the wall.
You're going to eat underneath?
Beg your pardon?
You're going to eat underneath the table?
I'm afraid you're a capricious boy, Rush. Mm. Our table is to be shoved up against the wall, Dave.
Yes.
And here we have a bit of ingenuity.
Oh?
A bit of clever ingenuity as provided by Gus Fuss.
What's that?
Well, instead of shoving our table up against the wall, see?
Yeah.
It's to be shoved up against the window.
You're going to eat outdoors?
What?
You're going to go outside the window?
Oh, no, one at a time, please. Yes, Dave.
You're going to stand outside the window and eat?
I'm not going to stand anywhere and eat.
Well, explain what you're talking about, then.
A ladder will be provided.
A step ladder?
Yes, with a sofa pillow on it.
And you're going to sit on that ladder outside the building?
The table will be flush with the windowsill. The step ladder will also be flush with the windowsill. I will be outside the tea shop. The other three fellows will be inside the tea shop. What difference does it make? We'll be four fellows sitting around a table eating our dinner, won't we?
Oh, no, Vic.
I consider it a very clever strategy.
The stuff you get yourself into.
I have sort of a halfway hunch you view the matter in a peculiar light.
The people going past on the street.
What about them?
Aren't they asked to view the matter in a peculiar light also? Here's a man sitting on a stepladder outside a restaurant, poking his head through the window.
Oh,
and he's...
heck, Sade.
Well, why does it always have to be you that holds the dirty end of the stick?
Would you have the big boss, Mr. Rubish, sitting on a stepladder eating through a window?
I wouldn't have anybody doing it.
Would you have Mr. Buller doing it?
I wouldn't have anybody doing it.
Would you have Gus Fuss, the smart executive from Dubuque, doing it?
I wouldn't have anybody doing it.
I know what you think. You think I'm being placed in a ridiculous position.
Well, aren't you?
No, I'm being a good fella and adjusting myself to circumstances. Why, I'm honored in the first place even to be invited to eat with three brilliant...
Telephone's ringing.
I'll get it. You people sit down and have dinner.
Maybe we better, Willie.
Okay.
Hello? Oh, yes, Mr. Rubish. Oh? Yeah, that's right. Why, not at all, Mr. Rubish. No, not a bit of it. Why, it'll be fun. Sure. Forget it. No, not at all. Yes, and I'll see you there in just a few minutes. Okay, Chief.
You bet. Bye-bye. You know who that was?
Mr. Robush.
Yes. Then he telephoned to say that he bet I wouldn't want to sit on any stepladder outside of any restaurant. And wouldn't blame me if I said the heck with it and announced I think Gus Fuss is a lame brain.
Uh-huh.
He's a grand old boy.
Yeah. Well, are you going to do it? Are you going to perch yourself on the stepladder outside the little tiny Dewiney tea shop?
Of course I'm going to do it. I'm going to like to do it. Sure. What?
I just glanced out the window.
Well?
It's raining. Raining pretty brisk.
Why, so it is.
Rush.
Yes?
Go upstairs.
Yes?
Get me an umbrella.
During the first 8 years or so, Vic and Sade consisted of only three characters, Vic, Sade, and the boy, Rush. Around 1940, a new character made his appearance, Sade's amiable Uncle Fletcher. As we got to know Uncle Fletcher, we found that his life consisted mainly of making excitement out of the rather humdrum events that transpired, and building those events into an imposing structure of vast importance. For example, when his landlady planned to get married, Uncle Fletcher took complete charge. He even planned to go on the honeymoon.
Is that Vic?
Yeah, well,
I'm even taking my landlady and her bridegroom's honeymoon for him. After the wedding, I'm traveling to Champaign, Urbana, Clinton, Decatur, Springfield, and Iliopolis. I'm traveling by myself. My landlady and her numbskull bridegroom are staying home. Miss Color don't want to leave her 100 chickens, and both her and Feedburn get car sick and dizzy when they ride on the train. So they're going to stay home, and I'm going to take their lame brain honeymoon for them.
Sometimes Uncle Fletcher's responsibilities seem to take on overwhelming proportions.
Do I have the responsibility for this wedding on my shoulders, or don't I have the responsibility for this wedding on my shoulders?
Well, as far as the honeymoon is concerned, you certainly have the responsibility.
And all the rest of the nitwit, numbskull, fathead details.
Well, I guess...
Who's hired the lame brain preacher? I'm hiring the lame brain preacher. Who has to fret and stew and worry and squirm figuring out wedding presents and trash? I do.
Well, I...
Who tramped all the way out to the Chicago and all railroad yards tonight after supper, risking their life dodging switch engines to get to the Bright Kentucky Hotel to find Michigan Fishigan from Fishigan, Michigan? I did. I tell you, they're running me ragged.
Who?
Everybody and their nitwit brother. I haven't got a numbskull second to call my own. I'm on the run from morning till night. No, it wouldn't surprise me none if I got caught up in the floodgates of activity and was destroyed against the rocks.
What rocks?
Yes. Thunder, I'm a man, not a machine.
I expect you're referring to the wedding?
I'm referring to Leota Keller getting married to Harry Feedburn.
Oh.
I wouldn't tell this to everybody. And Vic and Sadie, honey, I hope you won't leave it go any further. But I'm telling you right out frank and candid that I will never, as long as I live, undertake a project of this nature again. It's running me ragged. I've got to be careful.
Yes, sir. You'll get cut up in the frenzied floodgates of activity and be destroyed.
Destroyed against the rocks.
Exactly.
It's been an enormous undertaking. I'd never tack with it again in 1,000 years. Why, I no more than get 30 or 40 details arranged and some new problem arises. It's no child's play, I can tell you.
See, no.
But I plan to stick with her and turn in as neat a job on it as is humanly possible. No, I haven't just decided on a date for the wedding yet.
Mm.
I may make it 2 weeks from today. I may make it 2 weeks from tomorrow.
Mm.
I'll cipher it out. I'll cipher it out.
Yeah, sure you will.
What kind of a person was Uncle Fletcher in the eyes of the man who played the part?
Well, I could picture Uncle Fletcher as a type of man that if he worked, he rode a bicycle to work, and he always used one of those clamps around his pants legs to keep his pants from getting caught in the sprocket. And when he got dressed up on Sunday, he looked uncomfortable with a stiff, starched collar and a tie that somebody had given to him for Christmas 15 years ago. If he wore a hat, it would be uncomfortable, but it would be not a speck of dust or dirt on it, but it would leave a red rim around his head when he took his hat off. And he wore garters, which were very uncomfortable. And his type of fellow too would probably not only wear a belt but a pair of suspenders along with it. He always, you know, older people sometimes. All they can talk about is the disastrous things that happen. What happened to the friends of theirs? And you get to talking to them, they'll the most depressing conversations. This person actually maybe got hit by a fast passenger train or some awful thing happened to them. You know what I mean? And they just say it as if they enjoyed telling about it and it was just a matter of conversation. They didn't think anything of it. Well, that's Uncle Fletcher, too. Married a woman 21 years old, later died, fell off a five-story building and lived to tell it, and this was remarkable to him. And they have a way of making important, and least important things in their conversation. And they have told these stories numerous times, and they get bigger to them as they keep telling them about some guy that got on a train and went to Indiana and got off the train, began to cry, got back on the train, went home. This was something to remember. This man was famous, Uncle Fletcher. And the hyena grease, the fact that somebody had concocted that and made it in his kitchen, why, it was the finest thing in the world that ever happened. You know, everyone has in their family, in their circle of family relationships, at least one person who is just a little bit out, way out. And they would defend them to the death if anybody ridiculed them or made fun of them or even made a sly remark about them. Maybe it's an uncle, maybe it's a grandparent or a distant cousin. But Bickensade, and particularly the characterization of Uncle Fletcher, was a way-out relationship such as this. And I can remember Sade used to get very, very put out with Vic and Rush when they poked a little fun at Uncle Fletcher, because she loved him and she felt almost a religious obligation to stand up for him. But the listener can visualize Uncle Fletcher, can put their own Uncle Fletcher in Uncle Fletcher's place and laugh. Be free to laugh at. And this was my way, too, of poking a little fun at them.
But maybe we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here. Let's go back to the very beginning of Bickensade. Certainly, in the case of Bickensade, the beginning was the year 1932 when I came up from Cincinnati, where I'd been chief announcer for WLW, and joined the NBC announcing staff in Chicago. Paul Reimer, at that time, was a staff continuity writer. I don't think there was a trade lower than that. You wrote things like, and the next number to be played by the Jolly Blue Blazers will be Japanese Sandman. Paul ground this out by the hour, and I think he was pretty well sick of it at the time that I came there. And he was also writing a horrible dramatic effort called The Keystone Chronicle. In 1932, there was a lot of metamorphosis going on at NBC. A lot of soap operas were being put together. Chicago was evolving the 15-minute, five-week, what they called strip shows in those days. Suddenly, Dancer Fitzgerald and Sample, the agency in Chicago, suddenly realized that they had a lion by the tail and something ought to work here, and they sold the idea to Procter & Gamble, and Procter & Gamble immediately sensed that they could reach the American housewife with these soap operas. Those things all began to assume great importance in the daily lives of the American housewife. I don't think I'd been on Bickensade if it hadn't been for Charlie Lyon, a very good friend of mine who is now one of the producers of Truth or Consequences in Hollywood. Charlie had been the announcer on the initial efforts of Bickensade, sponsored, I think, by Jelky's Margarine. Well, Charlie either came up with a conflict of interest in clients, he couldn't work because he was working for somebody else that made butter or something, and anyway, suddenly up came Bickensade for grabs, and the program manager said, it's in your scheduled time during the day, would you like to announce it?
And I said, what is it? And he said, I don't know. It's a little family situation comedy. And I said, yes, I'd be delighted to do it. So I went in and I met Billy Idelson, who then was a very young, callow kid. I remember he wore a felt cap, which was an old hat with a crown cut with sort of a serrated edges and then turned up, and all it lacked to be a beanie was the propeller on top. I guess he was 8 or 9 years old. I don't think he was any... Was he 11? He looked 8 or 9. Byrne had just finished long runs in Empire Builders and the Campana's First Nighter and things of that nature, had done beautifully, and she was going to try a fling at this new creation called a soap opera. And Art Van Verschot, who was Art Van Harvey, who played Vic, came in. I think he was a space salesman for the Swine Breeders Gazette and an amateur actor of parts. So that you had three of the strangest careers. Billy, who had done little or no drama. Vic, who had done some drama. Byrne, who had done a great deal of drama and was a very fine, balanced actress. A writer who was one of the strangest people I think I ever met.
Well, I don't like to talk about the beginning because it's something that grew, and I feel that I'm making it up. I feel that I'm just making up a story because I know now that it was a successful show, but I didn't in the beginning. If I said I thought it was great, I know I'd be lying. I had no way of knowing how good it was. I wasn't that perceptive. And if I say I hated it, I would also be lying. I know I didn't dislike it because I did the job and I didn't do any shows that I didn't like. I only casually knew Paul Reimer, and I didn't know his writing. And I imagine the first few scripts are nothing like the scripts we know now and remember.
I had done a couple of shows as a kid. One was Gasoline Alley on WGN, and then a couple of others. And I hated radio acting. I didn't feel I was good. And I announced to my family that I no longer would do any of this. I wanted to play and so forth. And one day I came home and my mother said that she'd accepted a call for me to do a show on NBC called Vic and Sade, which I'd never heard of. It'd only been on a few days. And I went into a screaming tantrum saying I refused to do it. But she said, well, it's only for 4 days. They said the part would only be in for 4 days. And so that kind of mollified me. I said, okay, I'll do it for 4 days and that's it.
Billy was one of the most beautifully brought up young men I've ever known. Children. And if he felt that way, he wouldn't show it. We got a smile and warmth and everything because we were people and he was people. So that we wouldn't have known.
And I went down there and met the people and read the script and we rehearsed this show in the lobby, the 19th floor lobby. It was early in the morning, and in the studio that we were going to use, there was a show going on, so we couldn't rehearse in there. So we read, Van and Byrne and I sat on benches, the reception benches in the 19th floor lobby, and Clarence Menser, who was a program director of NBC, was our director, and he sat at the reception desk. But just reading this script, I knew this was an entirely different thing than anything I'd ever done before. And I was really confused because I liked it.
Yeah, but Billy is perceptive. Now, he's a writer himself and a producer by now. And I'm not at all surprised that Billy would have appreciated it from the start. Really, that doesn't surprise me. As young as he was.
I went in and did the show. It was the first show I only said one word on, hello. And I came down, did the second show, and that was a kind of a big emotional script. Rush was an adopted son. He was Sade's sister's boy, and this was during the Depression, and they had taken the boy because his sister couldn't afford to keep him anymore. And there was an emotional scene where he was homesick and wanted to go home, and Vic talks to him, and it was probably the most demanding role I'd ever had as a child actor, and I did it well because I was really in it. It was part of me. A whole different thing happened to me then. I think in that moment I became an actor. And I was sorry that I was only going to be in it 4 days. Well, it turned out I was in it 12 years.
I got a call to come down for an audition. I went up to the audition and there were three of us. Cliffy Soubirous, who was famous for his work in the old Wiener Minstrels, Little Cliffy and Pussin, and Sid Elstrom, very fine character actor, and I. We were the ones going to do the audition. Well, I read the part, and I just got the feeling that here was something that I liked to do, that I felt good in it.
I don't know if anyone else talked about the first time we heard Clarence Hartzell. Well, that was an amazing thing. Because, you know, the reason we brought Uncle Fletcher in was because Van was sick with heart trouble, and we had to bring in this other character's insurance. And an actor by the name of Sidney Elstrom, who was a very well-known character actor in Chicago, was thought to be the perfect Clarence Hartzell. It would be the perfect Uncle Fletcher. Excuse me. And everybody assumed that Sidney would play the part of Uncle Fletcher. And we had an audition of two or three other people just as a matter of form. But automatically we felt Sidney Elstrom was going to be Uncle Fletcher. I think of Clarence so completely as Uncle Fletcher that the two names are interchangeable. But anyway, we heard several people, and then Clarence came in to read, and none of us had ever seen him or heard of him before. Bernadine and I were reading with the actors that came in to read for Uncle Fletcher because Van was in the hospital. So it was just Bernadine and I sitting at a table, and there was a standing mic for the actors that came in to read for Uncle Fletcher. Well, Clarence came in, and we'd heard several other people, and they sounded okay. Clarence read the first line, and Bernard and I literally fell off the chair. We looked at each other, and it was just so perfect and so funny that we couldn't read anymore. We stopped reading, and we just looked at him, and it was just like this man had come from Mars, and was our conception of Clarence Hartzell. It hits both at the same time, our conception of Uncle Fletcher.
So after I got through, I thought, well, these two fellas have been here at NBC longer than I have. I was just a young squirt and, upstart. And they were certainly more experienced character actors than I was. So I put it out of my mind. I thought, well, here's another audition. I'm glad I was called. I was complimented that I would be called for such an important show. I just put it out of my mind. They said, wait outside for a while. So I went out in the lobby and waited. Pretty soon, the director came out and said, would you come in the studio again? So I went in, and they told me that I got the part.
The producer said, well, yeah, he was funny, but he's not the actor that Sidney Elstrom is, and so forth. And we fought for Clarence, because nobody had ever heard of him before, and we said there can't be anybody else than him. We insisted on having Clarence as Uncle Fletcher, and that's how he happened to get the job.
This is a tribute to Vic and Sade, a remembrance of something unique in old daytime radio. We've been hearing the voices of the Vic and Sade players and a few episodes from the show itself. This tribute, produced by Jack Foster and distributed without charge to radio stations everywhere, is being presented in two parts. This is the conclusion of part one. Now, here's today's version of the old-time radio announcer to tell you when to listen for the second part.